From NPR and WBUR, it's Here and Now. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. And as you can hear, Meghna, the sound quality for me is not as good as it usually is because I am very far away, broadcasting live today from the very first national park as the Park Service turns 100 years old this week. We are at Yellowstone National Park. I can see Old Faithful right in front of me. We are perched on a balcony at the Old Faithful Inn. There is steam rising up all around us from the many geysers here.
I would love to see Old Faithful erupt, hopefully while you're on the air.
Well, actually, and it just did a few minutes before we went on the air, so hopefully it will do it at some point during this show. But people that haven't been to Yellowstone may not know that in addition to the geysers, there are also a lot of great wildlife here, including the bison. And listen to this. Bison grunts there, recorded by an audio archivist for the park. We're going to be hearing a lot more sounds from Yellowstone as we continue our broadcasts.
Lucky guy. Well, meanwhile, it's been almost a month since the Zika virus first started spreading in the U.S. It's now in two different neighborhoods in Miami, and public health officials say it's likely it could pop up in other Gulf Coast states. Despite much media attention on the virus, there are still a lot of misconceptions about Zika. Dr. Christine Curry is an obstetrician-gynecologist at the University of Miami Hospital. And Dr. Curry, first of all, based on what we know about Zika, do you think people in the Miami area are too concerned about the virus or not concerned enough?
So I think there's a sweet spot in between not concerned and panic, and I think that's the place that we're trying to hit from a messaging standpoint. I think that for pregnant women, they're probably an appropriate level of worried, but I think for the average Miamian, there's still a lot of education that needs to be done in terms of community prevention.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that in just a moment, but since you did mention that pregnant women are right to be concerned and alarmed, let's talk about microcephaly for a moment. That's, of course, the most well-known birth defect that Zika causes, where, of course, the baby's head is much smaller than it should be, the brain doesn't fully develop. What percentage of women who get Zika while pregnant end up having a baby with microcephaly?
I wish we had enough science at this point to give you a hard number. The ranges from different studies are anywhere from 1% to almost a third of pregnancies when the mom is positive. And so we don't yet have enough data to be able to give that number definitively.
That's a huge difference in numbers there.
Yeah, it's a really big range, which I think reflects the different types of studies, whether they're modeling studies or laboratory-based, but it also, I think, highlights how much more we have to learn.
Okay. Well, Zika is primarily transmitted by mosquitoes, but it can also be sexually transmitted. So how long should someone wait after they test positive for Zika or know they have it, or after their partner has it, before trying to get pregnant?
So it depends on if it's a male or a female asking me the question. So for a woman who's asking that question, we are recommending, and the CDC is recommending, 2 months to delay trying to conceive from the point that you think you were exposed or know you were infected. For men, because the virus has been detected in the semen for much longer than in the blood or urine, men, we are recommending a delay of at least 6 months between the suspected or known infection.
I see. So does that mean that waiting 6 months or a year at this point in time, based on what we know, is a safe amount of time?
We think so. We think that the risk to the pregnancy is if mom, while pregnant, gets infected. Mm-hmm. We don't yet have any evidence and don't think that if she's infected now, that a future pregnancy after the infection has cleared will have any consequences.
Okay. Getting to the detection and prevention part of this story, I mean, Zika doesn't really cause any symptoms in a huge number of cases. So say you're a woman or part of a couple now that wants to get pregnant in the near future. I mean, would you recommend that people get tested for Zika before trying for a pregnancy if so many people are asymptomatic?
I think it really depends on the context and where you live in the United States or what country you live in, but it's a conversation with your healthcare provider. If you are traveling back and forth for business, if you're working in a community where there is known transmission, then it may be worth their while to have both partners tested. The biggest challenge is accessing testing for a couple who the woman's not pregnant and there is a male partner. the testing is really just through commercial labs at this point. It's not through the departments of health.
What kind of questions are you getting from your patients?
So we have a lot of pregnant patients that we take care of, and we are having conversations at every single prenatal visit about, are you wearing your bug spray? Do you have any issues with changing your wardrobe? How have you adapted to your new routine in terms of staying indoors most of the time, avoiding areas where there are mosquitoes? How have you adapted to, you know, putting condoms on during sex? We're having those conversations at every single prenatal visit.
Now, on the prevention side, then, what do you think is most important for people to know now?
So I think the biggest component of the prevention messaging is that it's not just about pregnant women preventing mosquito bites. This is a community issue. This is a local, a regional, a state issue. And so pregnant women can work as hard as they want. If non-pregnant women and men are not doing their part to wear mosquito repellent and long sleeves and get rid of standing water, then there will be increasing number of communities where there's Zika transmission, and sort of we all lose from that. So I think the most important prevention messaging is that we are absolutely all in this together.
Well, Dr. Christine Curry is an obstetrician-gynecologist at the University of Miami Hospital. Dr. Curry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, President Obama heads to Louisiana tomorrow to see for himself the effects of the devastating floods in the Baton Rouge area that have damaged tens of thousands of homes and more than a dozen people are dead. And there are new questions about whether a better warning system is needed to save lives and property in floods like this. Ryan Kailath is coastal reporter for WWNO. He joins us now. Ryan, first, what's the latest in the Baton Rouge area?
Baton Rouge, the city itself, has largely dried out, but this trillions of water that fell there is slowly making its way down to the Gulf of Mexico. And as it does, kind of rolling downhill there, it's rolling through town after town. So as lately as this weekend, there were towns that had their water level static at 2 or 3 feet, houses flooded to 2 or 3 feet, and they're just now draining out and getting into the sort of recovery phase of this.
And President Obama is going to visit the area tomorrow. He's been criticized for not coming until now, for not interrupting his vacation. How are people feeling about him and his visit?
You know, probably like everywhere around the country right now, it completely breaks down on partisan lines. Of the people I've talked to, some people want a reason to be mad at the president. Some people will love him no matter what. That's kind of how the conversation has gone. Some said, I'm glad he didn't come and take away our first responders' attention from they have other more important things to do. Other people were shaking their fists and saying, that Obama never gives us nothing.
And Donald Trump did visit the area last week. Was it difficult for the authorities to handle his visit?
From what I've heard, Trump's visit was all right. He didn't visit the city itself, or at least he didn't pause there. He went out to one of the more, it's not quite rural, but more rural parishes, where coincidentally he has much stronger support than in Baton Rouge, which is 50% black. So I think it was more of a small town thing. I haven't heard too much. I think the visit went all right.
Now, there are calls right now for a new system to measure the scale of a flood in advance so that people can prepare. Tell us how that would work exactly. It would be something like we have for tornadoes and hurricanes?
Exactly. And I mean, there's two parts to this. One is that historically, Baton Rouge isn't the place to deal with this. They've never faced this before. People escaped to Baton Rouge after Hurricane Katrina, and many of them never went back because Baton Rouge was seen as higher ground, seen as a place that doesn't flood. So the question is, how do you train people who have never flooded before from a weatherman's perspective, how to react and how to take these things seriously? So Dr. Marshall Shepard, he's a professor at UGA and used to be head of the American Meteorological Society. He called for something like the hurricane that's called the Saffir-Simpson scale, you know, where you've got category 1 through category 5, or even measurements. They measure earthquakes by the Richter scale. So he proposed a flood scale where you could assign levels of seriousness, where you could say, watch out, folks, this is a category 4 flood coming. Because one of the big problems that I think we've seen a lot with this is that this storm didn't have a name like Tropical Storm Bonnie or Hurricane Katrina. Instead, it was just, hey, folks, it's going to rain. And that's really hard from a meteorologist perspective to instill seriousness in people when you're saying it's going to rain.
And would a flood scale have helped in this case?
I can't say. So I've talked to several other meteorologists about it. One of them, his name is Josh Eaches. He's at the local TV station, but he's also doing his dissertation. He's a PhD candidate right now in weather communication. He's basically studying the question, how do you freak people out about the weather when you need to freak them out? He strongly disagreed with Marshall Shepard that we should have a flood scale. He said, yes, then you can assign some seriousness, but he said it also gives people permission to ignore smaller floods. They'll say, oh, that's just a Category 1 flood. I don't need to worry about that one. Look at how low the number is. And he was saying that's a big possible problem with assigning a scale. He'd rather keep it to inches, you know, 5 inches of rain, 15 inches of rain. He thinks that's a perfectly acceptable scale.
That's Ryan Kailath, who is a coastal reporter for WWNO, joining us from Louisiana. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
This is Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from Yellowstone National Park as the National Park Service celebrates 100 years of existence. Jonathan Jarvis is the 18th director of the Park Service. He's been in the job since 2009, but has been in the Park Service for more than 3 decades. I asked him, how would he describe the health of the parks right now?
Well, we're very healthy in terms of connecting to the American people. We hosted 312 million visitors in 2015, and I think we'll actually break that record this year. We're chronically underfunded to take care of the extraordinary number of visitors and extraordinary number of amazing places that we manage. So it's a good, bad, and ugly components.
Why are you so underfunded?
Well, we manage some 80 plus million acres in 412 sites that range from American Samoa to the Virgin Islands to grand places like Yosemite and Yellowstone to the Statue of Liberty and the Lincoln Memorial. All of those places require ongoing maintenance and care, plus the day-to-day use of cleaning up after millions of visitors and providing basic services like search and rescue and firefighting and the like. And that takes an appropriation, and we've been basically flat for about a decade in terms of federal appropriations.
But why is that? If you've got so many people in this country going and visiting the parks, why can't you and they convince their representatives that it makes sense to fund the Park Service to the tune that it actually needs? I mean, right now we're looking at, just for the maintenance backlog, billions of dollars.
Well, that's our goal, is for the American people to understand that in order to maintain these facilities and to provide for visitor enjoyment, it requires an annual appropriation. And frankly, I like to say we're a perpetuity organization on an annual appropriation, and that makes it very difficult to really meet the mission responsibilities of the agency. So part of it is to help the public understand that and ask for their assistance, both in terms of advocacy as well as philanthropic and volunteer support and constituent building as well.
But you have had some trouble, haven't you? I've seen you talk about this with the kind of government is bad mantra in Washington. And even though people may like the parks and hate other aspects of government, you're suffering because of that.
I think we are. I think there is a general attitude about reducing government spending, cutting back on the services that we provide the American people. And what I've been trying to show through the centennial is that the National Park Service represents the really best of America. We have the best places, the most important places to our natural history and our cultural history, and they require some basic level of support. And convincing Congress to do that is part of our long-term goal.
So you mentioned philanthropy, and there's been some criticism of that, not the individuals who have given, and there are certainly people who have given a lot of money to the National Park Service, but the corporations that have given, for example, Subaru has had its name plastered on park vehicles as part of a gift that they have given. Do you have any problem with that kind of thing?
Well, corporate support of the national parks really began in 1916. The railroads built some of our major lodges and were partners with us. In our 50th anniversary, some of your listeners will remember See the USA in your Chevrolet. That was a partnership with the automobile industry. So we've had a long-term relationship with corporate America, and frankly, we're not selling out. We're not renaming the national parks after a corporate interest. But we are open to working with them in partnership to market the parks, but not in a way that is offensive or feels like that the parks have been commercialized.
So what's the line that you can't cross?
Well, there are a lot of lines you can't cross that we draw very clearly with corporate America. I mean, obviously, they would love to have, in some cases, their name, stuck on something that is a prominent feature. But at the same time, they're smart about it. They know that this is the core of Americana, and it would be inappropriate to rename a feature or a national park after a corporate interest, no matter how much money they gave us. So. So
we won't
far,
be seeing Old Faithful brought to you by Dasani
no way.
Water or something like
no
that.
No way.
No. The Park Service has also been dealing with some sexual harassment issues. There was news recently about widespread abuse at Grand Canyon National Park. Why do you think that went on for so long without you or anyone else at the top knowing that the culture there was allowing that?
Well, the National Park Service is a big organization. We have 22,000 employees. We were unaware of this issue until it was brought directly to our attention via the investigation. And we have addressed it very aggressively at not only the Grand Canyon, but to ensure that it is not happening anywhere else in the system. And I don't, while the issue itself and these incidents are horrific and should never be tolerated. We're getting on top of it with a number of very aggressive actions.
So with all of these things that we've been talking about, what do you think is the biggest challenge facing the parks right now?
Well, I would categorize it in two buckets. I think going into our second century, I worry a lot about the effects of climate change to the national parks. We're already seeing signs of glaciers disappearing from places like Glacier National Park or Joshua Trees from Joshua Tree. These are the essential resources upon which these parks were established, and they are essentially threatened by the results of climate change. That's one big category, and the other is really relevancy. The last thing that I want to have in our second century is that the American public are apathetic about their national parks, that they don't feel that they tell their story. So our centennial initiative around Find Your Park and Let's Move Outside are all around connecting this next generation to their national parks.
And on that score, do you think enough has been done to get minorities interested in going to the parks?
Well, we certainly have had a very strong initiative in that area right now, reaching out to communities of color, reaching out to youth-serving organizations like Boys and Girls Clubs, also adding to the portfolio of the National Park Service by new parks that tell a more complex narrative. New places like Cesar Chavez in California or Harriet Tubman in Maryland and New York. Even our most recent site, which is the Stonewall Inn in New York City,
right,
that tells the LGBTQ story.
Well, and I have to say, I was out at Zion National Park earlier this year, which was incredible. But I did notice that a lot of the visitors were foreign visitors. They weren't Americans. How do you feel about that? Because on the one hand, I thought as I saw that and I interacted with people, oh, this is so cool. All these people have come from all over the world to see our parks. On the other hand, I thought, why aren't there more Americans here?
Well, the national parks are probably one of the top draws for international visitors to the United States. And so from a straight economic standpoint, that's a good thing. We love to have visitors come to the United States from around the world because they bring and contribute to the American economy. On the second hand, though, we want the visitation to the parks of the United States to be representative of the American demographic. At this point, it's not. So reach out and connecting with this more diverse community is one of our goals of the centennial.
We found a park in the Arctic Circle called Kobuk Valley. There are no roads in or out. It is one of the least visited parks in the system. Now, of course, not every park can be as popular as Yellowstone or the Grand Canyon. But what do you think is the most underrated park in the system?
Wow. We have a lot of sort of obscure parks, parks that people don't probably even know about. But
have you been to all of them at this point, by the way?
I have not.
Oh, okay.
So there's 412. I've been to maybe 300 in my my total career. I will talk a little bit about Wrangell St. Elias since it's a park that I worked in Alaska. It's the largest park in the system. It's 13 million acres. It's roughly the size of West Virginia or Switzerland. Denali gets all the attention because of the big mountain, but Wrangell's has really big mountains too, and glaciers and grizzly bears and caribou and moose and wolves and big rivers. And it's like, I like to say it looks like the United States as it came out of the Pleistocene. It's still an incredible place.
What drew you to this job when you were young?
Well, I loved being outside. I just loved being out in nature as a kid. I think that was the days when, you know, your parents kicked you out of the house and then, you know, come back in when it gets dark. And that's the way I grew up. And so I was lucky enough right out of college to land a seasonal job with the National Park Service here in Washington, D.C., on the National Mall, the Bicentennial Information Center. And I really loved the mission of the service, this public service agency that was committed to protecting and interpreting these incredible places. So I fell in love with the mission and have stayed with it for 4 decades.
And you've ended up walking the halls of Congress now as the director of the National Park Service. You don't even get the perk of being able to be based in some awesome park.
Well, I had my turn out there. I lived in some incredible places, Crater Lake, Guadalupe Mountains, North Cascades. And then, you know, somebody's got to come back to Washington and do battle for this place, this mission. And I was ready to do that.
That's Jonathan Jarvis, the director of the National Park Service. Director Jarvis, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. Really appreciate it.
And again, I'm here at Yellowstone National Park today. Old Faithful still steaming in front of me. I've been tweeting some photos at Jeremy Hobson on Twitter. Check them out.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
The Olympics in Rio ended last night with a spectacular closing ceremony and the official handover to Tokyo, which will host the 2020 Summer Games. The Games in Brazil featured more than 11,000 athletes and 16 days of competition. Well, joining us now for a wrap-up of the Rio Games is the BBC's Camila Costa from Rio. And Camila, what is the feeling there today? Because in the run-up to these Games, there were concerns that Brazil wasn't ready. But now that it's all over, do people in Rio feel as it was a success?
Yes, the overall feeling is of pride. Brazilians feel like they proved once again after the World Cup that they can host an event like this to the whole world. Also, Brazil had its best performance in an Olympic Games ever. It is quite a good feeling. But let's see how long it will last because we have some difficult days ahead for us still. Brazil is still in the middle of an economic crisis and a political crisis as well. So there's a lot coming up.
A great deal coming up. But I wonder if, I mean, you mentioned Brazil's excellent performance athletically in the games, taking home gold in men's soccer and men's volleyball as well. Is there any sense that the successful games, both athletically and as the host nation, has helped to take the edge off all the concerns and tensions around, as you said, those political and economic problems, those considerable problems that Brazil still faces?
Definitely, absolutely, at least for a little while. Obviously, we have bigger problems than, you know, any gold medals would let us forget.
Of course.
But obviously, winning gold in football and again against Germany after that World Cup final had a special taste. People felt afterwards like, we won the Olympics. Olympics, right? I mean, whatever medal tables, we just won the Olympics.
Yeah, it's always, I have to say, it's just a joy to see the Brazilian style of play on the soccer field as well. But let's talk about some of the other sports as well. The silver medal winner in yesterday's marathon, Feisa Lelisa, he raised and crossed his arms in sort of an X symbol as he crossed the finish line. He said it was in protest. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, Lelisa is from Oromia. That gesture is a gesture made by the Oromo people who have suffered brutal police crackdowns in the past few months. Human rights groups actually say that the Ethiopian security forces have killed hundreds of people. Actually, Lisa said, explaining his actions later, that it is difficult to protest in his own country. So this was a very serious moment, and in a way, for many people, a very brave thing for him to do as well, especially considering that the Olympic Committee does not allow political protests. It was very powerful.
Well, finally, Camilla, of course, I know it's 4 years away, but the closing ceremonies did highlight the fact that Tokyo is next in hosting the Summer Games in 2020. Do you have a sense there from officials about what the expectations will be for Tokyo?
There are a lot of expectations, especially here in Brazil. People did have preconceived notions about what an Olympic Games in Rio would be like. And people here also have that about Japan, especially after that introduction for Tokyo. Tokyo 2020 and the Rio closing ceremony with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe coming up dressed as Mario. People went completely crazy over that. Some have been joking on social media that they're even expecting a stadium that gets up and transforms into a robot. So jokes aside, there's still a lot of expectation, of good expectation.
Well, that's the BBC's Camilla Costa speaking with us from Rio. Camilla, thank you so very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from the Old Faithful Inn at Yellowstone National Park. The Park Service is celebrating its 100th birthday this week. And one thing a lot of people are eager to see when they make a trip to the country's first national park is the grizzly bear. Just be careful you don't get too close. And a warning, we'll hear from an attack victim, and it may be disturbing to some. Here's Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd.
Sometimes a date has a way of staying with you.
3 years ago, June 20th, 2013.
It was a beautiful morning on Nick Patrick's family ranch about 40 miles outside of Yellowstone.
So I run a few cattle and horses and grow a little hay and just repair everything that is fallen down.
Out on the South Fork of the Shoshone River, Patrick has a view of 10,000-foot peaks. Dense thickets of willows and cottonwoods stand tall on his land.
If you went up this road to the end of it, and then got on a horse, you could ride over into Jackson.
Some might call this God's country, but on that day in June, 3 years ago, it was also grizzly country. Patrick was working down near the trees, irrigating his crops.
Which I've done for 50 years. And as I was doing that, I heard my little dog, who's usually by my side, just screaming, entangled up with something. And I'd been in some epic raccoon dog battles in that same spot. So like a fool, I rushed around the corner and yelled, "Hey," and immediately saw that 25 feet away from me was a sow grizzly with two little bitty cubs. And she just looked at me, said, "You're next," and she was on me within 3 or 4 seconds.
I was going to ask what was going through your mind when you saw the sow 25 feet from you, but I wonder if you even had time to think.
Yeah, I had an irrigating shovel. I had time to cock that and slam her in the head with that as she came in, but it didn't do any good. And actually, it kind of left me exposed because I didn't have my hands up because of the swing. And so the first thing she did was reach up and bite me in the face. And then it was just a melee from there. And it's kind of like other prey animals. You kind of go into a suspended you don't really feel any pain, you can feel pressure, but she at one point grabbed me by my left knee and drug me about 20 feet and bit me through the hand, and then she finally decided she'd, I guess, taught me a lesson, and she took off. Unfortunately, she took off in the wrong direction where her cubs were. I could hear her coming back down the hill and grunting, and she tied into me again.
It's almost impossible to imagine, but Patrick says if you want to know what it's like to be rendered powerless by a 600-pound grizzly, there is a way to do it. Watch a 2015 film called The Revenant, and this haunting scene when a frontiersman played by Leonardo DiCaprio is walking through the woods and then suddenly is in the jaws of a massive mother bear.
That's exactly what it was like.
at that point, like when you got after the second time, did you think that you had survived it? Or, I mean, did you feel like you were still in major trouble physically?
Oh, the second time she came back, I had that feeling that, you know, if this is what you're here for, get it over with, because I've had it. I've had all of this I want.
The bear didn't want to kill Patrick because, of course, she could have. She bit through his hand and through his knee and left an open wound across his face. He wears a prosthesis today where his nose used to be. It's a shocking story and a rare one. Carrie Gunther says you're as likely to be killed by lightning.
Well, we average over 4 million visits a year, and we average one bear attack per year. So the odds overall are pretty low.
Gunther is Yellowstone's bear biologist, and we met outside his office in front of the towering Mount Everts. Gunther can put Patrick's attack in perspective because he's been tracking grizzlies around here for more than three decades.
When I first started working in Yellowstone Park, it was pretty rare to see a grizzly bear. So if you saw a dozen bears in a summer, you considered that a pretty good bear year. Today, you can easily see a dozen bears in one morning.
So were there like a handful of them 30 years ago, and now how many? Do you have any estimates of how many there are?
Well, there's possibly as few as 136 in 1975, and now we believe there's well over 700.
That's because the federal government listed the grizzly as a threatened species in 1975. And ever since then, it's protected the bear from hunters and ranchers who took matters into their own hands when grizzlies devoured their livestock. But with their numbers rebounding, there's talk of delisting the bears.
Is this something that you think about more often now because there are so many more grizzly bears in the park, because the recovery has been so good? Are you thinking more about the interactions with humans?
Yes, we're working on our safety messaging because there's a lot more bears and visitation keeps increasing, so there's a lot more people. So we're having more encounters, and we're trying to get better at teaching people how to avoid having surprise encounters in the first place, and then how to react if they do have a surprise encounter.
So here's a crash course, Grizzly 101, by Yellowstone professor Carrie Gunther.
One of the easiest things to do is find at least two friends to hike with. We almost never get anyone attacked that's hiking in a group of three or more. Bears respect things that are bigger than they are and that outnumber them.
Really, two is not enough.
Two is not enough. Two is better than one, but three is better than two. Now, if you do have a surprise encounter, initially what we recommend is slowly backing away, because a lot of times that'll diffuse the situation, shows the bear that you're really not a threat to those cubs. But if the bear charges, you want to stop and stand your ground. Just by standing your ground, most of the time the bear's going to veer off if it charges or stop short. Standing your ground is important.
Okay, Carrie, but I want to interrupt you there, because the thought of standing your ground when a grizzly bear, you know, several hundred pound animal, is charging at you, every fiber of your being is going to be telling you to run the other direction, and you say you've just got to put your shoes in the ground and stay put.
Yes. And, you know, when I first started working here over 30 years ago, that was a pretty tough thing to do. It took a lot of courage. Now, today there's a product, bear spray, that's over 90% effective at stopping aggressive behavior in bears. And one of the big things with bear spray, it gives people the courage to stand their ground. Carrying bear spray is a real important thing anytime you're hiking, fishing, any kind of recreation in bear country.
And I see you've got some bear spray in a holster on your hip right there.
If it's in your pack, again, a bear is going to be charging at about 44 feet per second. You don't have time to take a pack off and get bear spray out of a pocket. So you want to have it on a holster, either on your chest or on your hip, where you can get to it immediately.
What is it? It's just like pepper spray for bears?
It's a hot pepper spray for bears. It comes out in a really fine mist, so it gets into their eyes. They breathe it in, fills the lungs. The same type of product used by law enforcement, but it's a hotter concentration, and it comes out in a big cloud, so you don't have to even be a good aim to use it. You just have to get it out, get the safety tab off, and press the trigger.
You got to do all that while your hands are shaking and while you've got a bear charging right down at you.
That's right. And so you want to practice ahead of time so that when the bear charges, it's instinctual that you know exactly what to do.
Okay, well, should we practice?
Let's practice.
Okay.
Yeah, let's see which way the wind's going here. This way. So I take the top of the holster off. You want to aim slightly downward. The bear, again, is coming in at about 44 feet per second. If you aim too high, it could run right underneath before that bear spray can settle down. So I aim just slightly downward, press the trigger.
Whoa.
And the bear just has to run through it. And as the bear's running through it, you just keep spraying right into the bear's face.
Okay, so the spray really gets like what I'm taking one, two, three steps here, and it seems got a little bit of it in.
And it's still out there. It's expanding as it goes out, so it's harder to see, but it's drifting out there about 30 feet.
By the way, that bear spray was just for practice. It wasn't the real thing. So even if it did get caught in my lungs, it wasn't nearly as bad as it could have been. So note to self, don't walk into the cloud of bear spray after you pull the trigger. Anyway, Nick Patrick, the rancher who was mauled outside the park, says bear spray might have helped him if he had it, but he didn't. He says it was his fault for being unprepared, and for sure, he does not blame the animal.
I knew the bears around here. I've been an advocate for the grizzlies for, you know, over 40 years. All she was doing is what any good mother would have done. She was just taking on the next comer because she had an agenda, and that was keeping her baby safe. That's her job. Grizzlies define wildness. And if we can have that, that in our ecosystem, if we can support grizzlies and they can live here and thrive here, then we're doing something right. We're keeping this country in good shape.
And that's pretty big of a man who knows what it's like to feel incredibly small in this wild country. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Yellowstone National Park.
Funerals are being held in Turkey for the victims of Saturday's attack on a Kurdish wedding party. One of the survivors spoke to the BBC.
Our friends and neighbors were there. We're sad and in pain. The attack was an atrocity. We want to end these massacres.
More than 50 people were killed, dozens more wounded, and many of the victims are children. In fact, officials in Turkey say the suicide bomber himself was a child, somewhere between 12 to 14 years old. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan blamed ISIS for the attack. He says the extremist group is trying to destabilize Turkey by exploiting ethnic and religious tensions. Well, Gonul Tol is the founding director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Turkish Studies. She's with us from Washington. Gonul, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
First of all, just give us your reaction to what happened on Saturday, and specifically the fact that many of the victims were children and the bomber himself seemed to be less than 14 years old.
Yes, obviously this is not the first time that ISIS has used child soldiers and suicide bombers. It's done that in Iraq, in Syria, elsewhere in the region. But in Turkey, ISIS has launched several attacks, suicide bombings in the past, but this is the first time that they're using a child suicide bomber. According to security officials, they could have placed the explosives on the child without his knowledge and detonated it remotely. So that is one of the debates that the security officials are having at the moment.
It is very hard to hear that and keep an appropriate emotional remove, to be perfectly honest. So you've mentioned ISIS here. President Erdogan says the attack was carried out by ISIS. Has that been confirmed?
No, ISIS rarely claims responsibility for the attacks in Turkey. Since 2015, in ISIS suicide bombings, hundreds of people have been killed, but ISIS has never claimed responsibility. But the target that it chose indicates that in fact it was ISIS that carried out the attack, because it was mostly the neighborhood which the bombing occurred is a predominantly Kurdish area, and the wedding couple are said to be members of the pro-Kurdish HDP. So the target itself indicates that it was an ISIS attack.
Hmm. Now, the location where the bombing took place is near Turkey's border with Syria. You also mentioned the fact that it was a Kurdish wedding party. Does the location carry a particular significance given it's so close to Syria?
Yes, Gaziantep, the town, is known to harbor ISIS sleeper cells. And I think also the timing is very important here, because the attack comes after Kurdish forces in Syria recaptured the northern Syrian town Manbij, which is a logistical hub for the Islamic State. And this has happened recently. So as ISIS loses more territory in Syria, I think we'll see more of those attacks. But also, I think it's important to underline that that Turkey is becoming a target of ISIS recently because Syrian rebels are preparing to launch an operation to capture another town held by ISIS at the border with Turkey. And the rebels will launch the attack from inside Turkey, reportedly in a few days. So I think that's one of the reasons why we are seeing this attack now, and Turkey is stepping up its efforts against the Islamic State. And also it's important to note that Turkey recently announced that it would play a more active role in Syria in the coming 6 months, and also said that Assad could stay in power during a transition. So taken all together, I think that the timing is important in the sense that ISIS is losing territory and Turkey is stepping up its efforts in the fight against ISIS.
So this attack on a Kurdish wedding party, I mean, it's Kurdish forces that have been having some success in fighting ISIS. But of course, Turkey has a long-standing conflict with the Kurds. And yet we hear President Erdogan say that ISIS is trying to destabilize Turkey by exploiting those long-standing ethnic and religious tensions. And of course, all of this happens with the backdrop of the failed coup that we had not that long ago. So what does this tell us about how President Erdogan is balancing conflicts with Kurds versus conflicts with ISIS?
It's going to be very difficult. And you're right, it's an irony because President Erdogan himself has been exploiting those ethnic tensions. The ceasefire between the Kurdish PKK and the state broke down last year. And since then, Erdogan has stepped up attacks against the PKK. And Kurds have been victimized since then. There are hundreds and thousands of people, mostly civilians, have been killed in the clashes. So one of the reasons why ISIS refuses to claim responsibility for its attack inside Turkey is that it really wants to inflame those ethnic tensions.
Well, Gonul Tol is the founding director of the Middle East Institute Center for Turkish Studies. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.